Welcome to Uprising, Ashraf Khalil.
Hello. It's good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, your book has history and a description of what happened last year at a level of detail that I think Americans just didn't get, even if they were paying close attention to what was happening in Egypt. And I like that you start the story way back to where Mubarak and how Mubarak first took power. And you have a chapter called Accidental Dictator, mm-hmm. where, of all things, you compare him to Dan Quayle.
Yep.
Most Americans probably don't realize that Mubarak doesn't fit the profile of the Saddam Hussein type, the fascist, angry dictator who is brutal. But rather, he, as you say, came into power for more of what he is not rather than what he is. Tell us that story.
Yeah, the way that I framed it is that Mubarak kind of, as you said, became president of Egypt, was in position to become president of Egypt almost as much because of his flaws as because of his positive characteristics, in that Anwar Sadat, his predecessor as president, named him vice president largely because he was kind of regarded as not smart enough or ambitious enough to conspire for the top job. I mean, and he, when he became the president, he was kind of a national punchline. People called him the laughing cow, la vache qui rit, after a brand of French cheese that was available in Egypt. So he was the laughing cow. That was his name. And the Dan Quayle, I spin out this analogy whereby imagine if, George Bush the first president, dies in office, Dan Quayle becomes president, and 30 years later, Dan Quayle is still president and naming half the country after himself and grooming his children for the job.
So he, in many ways, was it because of that sort of quality of his that in many ways his dictatorship was a sort of stealth dictatorship? That people didn't realize how bad it was going to be under him till 30 years past?
It really was. And I don't think the place really went toxic until the late 90s or so. Mm-hmm. I mean, he came in on a decent amount of goodwill. I mean, he wasn't regarded as particularly imaginative, or he was kind of regarded as a bit of a dullard and not a really free thinker or imaginative thinker. But Sadat, his predecessor, was a roller coaster ride. Was very emotional, was highly intelligent, veered left and right, had temper tantrums, sort of took the country in wild directions, flip-flopped between the Americans and the Russians, and finally signed Camp David, which was very controversial inside of Egypt and kind of rammed that down his people's throats. And so I think people regarded Mubarak as it was just kind of a relief that the roller coaster ride was over. If the guy's a little bit dull and a little bit unimaginative, maybe we could use a break, I think. Now, so he's from these humble beginnings, he did kind of build up and was regarded as a reasonably sincere guy. Ironically, he was regarded as an anti-corruption crusader at the beginning. This was something that surprised me until I started doing interviews with people like older generation Egyptians. And so many people remembered, I mean, given how the rampant corruption that really took over and seemed to sort of personify the Mubarak regime towards the end, one of the first things he did was a major anti-corruption push and arrested some major sort of fixers and political bosses from the Sadat era. And he gave an iconic speech that so many people from that generation could quote it to me. The line was that the death shroud has no pockets. This is what Mubarak said in his speech, which is just a flowery way of saying you can't take it with you, so why bother stealing all this? And in retrospect, maybe he was just clearing out Sadat's money men to make way for his own money men. But ironically, those first 10 years, he was regarded as reasonably clean, anti-corruption, and probably just a nice calming antidote from the wildness of Sadat.
It seems as though central to the story of Egypt's dictators and the revolution is relations with the U.S. How did Hosni Mubarak further entrench the legacy started under Sadat of U.S.-Egypt relations?
Well, you're correct in saying that it's like, he didn't make the policy. I don't think Mubarak made big moves like that. He didn't think on that level. He continued Sadat's big move, which was to entrench, as you said, Egypt-U.S. relations, and specifically around Camp David, which meant peace with Israel. And that became very controversial as the years went on. So, yes, he put Egypt very deeply into the American camp and really, he oversaw the real flowering of the relationship, not just between the executive branches, but between the militaries and between the intelligence services, the several successive generations of Egyptian military men have been trained in America. And the depth of the relations between the Pentagon and the CIA and their counterparts in Egypt really took hold under Mubarak.
And so in many ways, did he turn Egypt even more so into a sort of regional pariah?
Sadat did that. Egypt was expelled from the Arab League after Camp David. And Egypt was the leader of the Arab League, and the Arab League sort of fired Egypt and moved to, I believe, Tunisia for a couple of years. So at first, Mubarak oversaw Egypt's gradual reintegration into the Arab states. The Arab League eventually moved back to Cairo, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if he turned Egypt into a pariah so much as he made it palatable for other Arab countries to get on board the U.S. train. Jordan followed suit not long after. This is the days Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. They weren't as deeply entrenched with the U.S. back then. So I think it was almost the opposite. Instead of making Egypt a pariah, he made it okay for the others to get in on the American gravy train, so to speak.
Speaking of the gravy train, then how did Egypt benefit financially from relations with the U.S.?
Well, a lot has been made of the what's called the Camp David funding. $1.3 billion in military aid, close to $2 billion total. And it's very calibrated. Israel receives X, Egypt receives just a little bit less. And that's been sort of codified for 30-plus years now. But whether or not this money is super necessary is very debatable. I mean, right now we're in a situation where the U.S. Congress is sort of threatening to do something about this funding because of the situation with the Egyptian or the American non-governmental organization workers that are facing trial in Egypt. And there's this threat about the Camp David money. And I kind of think the Camp David money is a little bit overrated because the vast majority of it goes into the military and is not seen by normal Egyptians. The rest is run through the USAID machine,
right,
which, I'm sure you have very, very savvy listeners. The USAID machine, 70% of that comes back to America or goes into the pockets of Americans. And some good does get done for Egyptians through that. But the country doesn't rise or fall based on that funding. It's almost more psychological than anything else. We need the IMF money far more than we need the annual, shipment of tanks and planes from the U.S.
In your book, you write about how, in many ways, Mubarak's ultimate crime, you say, will be treating his people with contempt. He wasn't like Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
I should mention he played an interesting role during the 1991 Gulf War, which also was a turning point in the way his fellow Egyptians saw him.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about how he managed to slowly begin inspiring the ire of his own people, but not with big dramatic ways, not with the mass graves that Iraqis had to
deal with.
This
is one of the things that, during the revolution, I would have editors asking me these questions, and I would say, look, bottom line, there's not going to be revelations of mass graves in Egypt. It wasn't that kind of dictatorship. I think I've got a line in there that says that as modern dictators go, he might not crack the top 10.
Mm.
It was a different kind of a place. It was more subtle than that. And as I as you said, I regard one of his crimes as sort of overseeing this collapse of Egyptian pride in themselves and self-respect, and this feeling of helplessness just became so entrenched under Mubarak that his reign, I think, really had a very corrosive effect on Egyptian society and psychology. It wasn't the direct violent traumas inflicted by Hafez al-Assad in Syria, by Saddam Hussein, by a whole host of others. It was more this long-term effect of helplessness, of you know, teaching his people that their opinion didn't matter and that kind of they didn't matter. I remember very well a protest I covered in about 2000. It was about Israel and Palestine. There was new action somewhere. You know, something was happening. Second Intifada was kicking off, I'm sure. And I saw a group of young students being chased down the street by riot cops with billy clubs, not like right around the corner from my house in Cairo. And I'm watching this with store owners on the street, and I asked the shopkeepers, like, what do you think of what you just saw? And he said, if we had any dignity, we would be with them. Mm. In that people felt strongly about things, but they just felt helpless. They were taught, it was kind of ingrained in the Egyptian personality at that point. The phrase in Egypt is imshi gembel heta, walk next to the wall. And that's code for mind your business, feed your family, don't involve yourself in affairs of governance that are above your station. And that's kind of – that really got corrosive during the Mubarak era. It was this combination of helplessness and having no trusted societal arbiters, no uncorrupted national institutions. The police became this predatory force. The judges, small claims court, et cetera, you couldn't really trust them. If there was a dispute between you and I, a business dispute, there wasn't – who would we go to? There wasn't anyone we would trust to arbitrate the dispute. So it became this battle of wasta, of connections, of who's your uncle, who's my uncle, who knows who in the presidency, who knows who in the governor's office. And it just became – so Mubarak's – the long-term effect of Mubarak's reign, it really spread cynicism. It spread self-loathing. Almost.
Well, you brought up the riot cops, and the Interior Ministry in Egypt mm-hmm. under Mubarak is an important part of the story as
yes.
well. And ultimately, even if Mubarak may not have been directly controlling how the ministry conducted the security forces on the ground, it became a sort of manifestation or symbol of his dictatorship. Tell us about how that even evolved, how these security forces became to be this very controlling force on the streets, and also who the security forces themselves were comprised of.
I point to somewhere in the mid-90s as a turning point in the relationship where the interior ministry, when a new interior minister came, if you'll recall, in 1997 was the Luxor massacre, which was a huge blow. You know, Islamist gunmen took over, basically killed several dozen tourists at a temple in Luxor, Egypt, and it was horrific, and it was a huge black eye. It was for the Egyptian security forces and a nightmare for Egypt in terms of tourism. And after that, a new interior minister came in, and I think things sort of changed after that. In that there was just the handcuffs were off at this point. They were free to do whatever they wanted, no questions asked, and the government, there was no oversight. There was no way to weed out a bad officer. There was no one to take a police brutality case to, and you just had this blanket dedication to the cover up. You know, they would unify. No matter what the police brutality case, no matter what evidence you had against a police officer, he would be backed by the government and by the full force of the government, which means he'd be backed by the coroner. He would be backed by the case would go to a compliant judge, et cetera, et cetera. And the long term effect of that really did the police became kind of predatory, I think. And the last thing you would ever want, you never went to an Egyptian police officer for help in those last 15 years. You just wanted them to leave you alone. They brought nothing good into your life. And at the same time, on a higher level within the Interior Ministry, an organization called Mubahis Emne Daula, State Security Investigations, became dominant. The new Interior Minister who came in after Luxor, Habib al-Adli, was the former head of state security. So when he became interior minister, they became this monolith, this ministry within the ministry. Mm. And state security, those last 15 years, was into everything. Who, you know, the newspaper editors, college deans, college professors, syndicate elections, and, you know, to say nothing of street-level politics and parliamentary elections. You needed to get a sign-off from Emne Daula, from state security, to do almost anything. They were this octopus. And I think that became symbolic of the way things went in those last 15 years under Mubarak. Mm. And really, I do think it was failure to rein in the police forces that brought him down. I think, you know, there was an iconic case of a young man named Khalid Said in Alexandria, June 2010, who was beaten to death by police officers in public and in front of witnesses. And he became the symbol of decades of misbehavior by the police, and not just beating deaths, you know, just casual humiliations, mafia-style shakedowns, tiny little power games and humiliations that happened every day with civilians.
And I want to bring up Khalid Said later, specifically as it relates to the sort of class divisions in Egypt.
Yes.
But let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Ashraf Khalil. He's an independent correspondent based in Cairo, Egypt. And we're discussing his new book, Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation. Well, let's just a little bit more history before we go to what happened on January 25th, 2011. And that is the moment when the U.S. is about to wage war on Iraq. Here in the U.S., people remember the mass protests, but they were also global protests. They're known as the day in global history, in world history, when more protesters were out on the streets in more countries than we know of. Mm-hmm. And it happened in Cairo, too. How did what happened in Cairo in terms of the protests against the impending U.S. war in Iraq also sort of signal a turning point for the end of Mubarak's regime?
It's really interesting. It's one of those things that it wasn't until I started to get into the research on the book that I realized what a pivotal moment that was. I mean, just as background, in the buildup to the war, you know, it was a several-month escalation before the U.S.-led coalition invaded Iraq and ousted Saddam Hussein. Mubarak had spoken out publicly against it, saying this is a bad idea. This is going to be a disaster. But people thought that was kind of face-saving and that he was pretty much on board with the project. He let U.S. warships sail through the Suez Canal, basically saying, hey, what can I do? My hands are tied. It's a public waterway. It would be irresponsible. I can't just shut down the Suez Canal. But people thought that he was complicit in what was regarded as essentially an imperialist move. But, you know, I'm speaking from the minds of the majority of the Egyptian population. On the night that the attacks began, March 20th, I believe, 2003, was the first occupation of Tahrir. Protesters overwhelmed security forces and took over Tahrir Square. And it's kind of an underreported footnote in Egyptian history. And I remember seeing this. I was actually in Qatar at the time. I was covering CENTCOM. I was covering the U.S. Military Command Center in Qatar at the time. So I'm watching this on television and I'm seeing images I'd never seen before of the central security, the riot police on the run, protesters sort of carrying batons and shields and things like that. And they took over Tahrir Square for the first time. And they didn't hold it. They basically held a noisy rally and party for several hours and then went home voluntarily. But so many people pointed to that moment as a crucial moment of weakness by Mubarak, as a moment of ascendancy by the activist forces. One activist that I spoke with a lot, a socialist activist, said that was the moment when people started focusing internally as well. It wasn't just after that point there was a strategic decision to not just talk about foreign policy issues. Previously, most of the protests had been about Israel or America. It was foreign policy, not domestic. And a different tone came into the protests after that.
You say in your book, what started with down with America turned into down with Mubarak.
That's a quote from an activist who points to that moment of March 2003 as a point of no return.
Well, let's talk briefly about Tahrir Square. Well, we should talk a little bit more than briefly about Tahrir Square. It's the title of your book, Tahrir Means Liberation.
Yes.
And I want to quote from your book where you say, Tahrir became the epicenter of a revolution. Protesters not only transformed it, they were themselves transformed by their presence in it. Tahrir became a revolutionary organism unto itself, bigger than any one citizen or political faction, and more important, bigger than Mubarak and his government. Why was this geographic space so important? And How did it kind of become its own republic, if you will, as you describe?
It's one of the most amazing things of the entire revolution was just the significance that Tahrir took on. It wasn't the site of protests. 5 years ago, people weren't protesting in Tahrir Square. They were protesting at Cairo University or protesting at the Journalist Syndicate or the Lawyers Syndicate. Those were the hotbeds in Cairo. So it's kind of, you know, Tahrir is sort of the geographic heart of Cairo, but it didn't have real political significance before. This kind of happened on its own. And there is an instinct to, you know, when you have a big crowd, oh, let's take Tahrir, as happened in 2003. But during the revolution, this just happened very organically and very effortlessly. And people knew – sorry. People knew once they held Tahrir, it really did – they transformed it and they were transformed by it. It was this amazing thing. There was this kind of groupthink in the most positive possible sense of that term, in that there seemed to be this effortless communication among all these protesters of different ideologies, different socioeconomic backgrounds. But once they were in Tahrir, I mean, one of the things that I really fixate on is the first thing the protesters did when they took over Tahrir Square on January 28th, they cleaned it. And you really have to have spent a little bit of time in modern day Egypt to know how amazing that is, in that people don't really clean up after themselves. There's not a sense of community. There's not a sense of ownership. And I can partially lay that on Mubarak and partially on just people's behavior and a need to kind of like retrain people on the idea of citizenship and living in a community. But the people, when they took over Tahrir Square, they kept it clean. They cleaned it every day. Every time I went into Tahrir Square, the streets there were cleaner than the street outside my apartment in Giza has ever been. And that's powerful. That is meaningful. And it just became it was just this special place. And I still, you know, as you would walk into Tahrir Square, you would pass through lines of security checkpoints, individual volunteers, not military, you know, volunteers with badges around their neck would pat you down and check your ID, multiple redundant levels of pat downs. And they were very thorough and very polite. They would apologize as they did it, but they had a job to do. And as you entered Tahrir, there would be a welcoming line, people clapping and cheering.
Wow.
And saying, "Welcome to liberated ground." It really felt like its own organism. And that changed almost immediately after Mubarak stepped down. Mm. That was one of the things I mentioned in the book is that sexual harassment in Tahrir Square was almost unknown during the revolution. And there was a lot of female revolutionaries, a lot of female participants in this revolution from day one. But then people want to ask about Laura Logan. People want to, you know, that was the 11th. On the day that Mubarak resigned, all the unreformed folks got up off their couches and came to join the winning side, and the place changed immediately. Mm. And it wasn't. Laura Logan was merely the most egregious and most publicized example. But, you know, I remember being at a brunch on the day after the resignation with friends, sort of a celebratory get together, and several female friends said, "Oh yeah, I was in Tahrir last night and it was really intense and nasty and I couldn't stay." And it was so depressing to hear that. It's like, oh God, we're back to that again. But it really was, it was a special place. I'm nostalgic for Tahrir during those 18 days.
Mm. And I do want to talk about the aftermath of what happened once Mubarak stepped down. But let's also discuss a little bit of now some of the activist sparks to the revolution. We mentioned Khalid Saeed,
yes,
this young Egyptian, and how he you say Khalid Saeed, this young guy who was beaten to death for, what, having hair that was too long.
The reasons are still a mystery.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time trying to decide because they went for him.
Right.
It wasn't accidental. He wasn't just walking home and ran across an officer in a bad mood and things spiraled out of control. I spent a lot of time and I realized that when I started doing the book, not many people had actually deconstructed what happened on that day. So I went and I interviewed as many people as possible and all, you know, as many witnesses as possible.
Right.
They went for him. And I still don't know why.
Right. Hmm. Well, ultimately, what came of his death is also a very important story. You say Khalid Saeed showed the middle class that their devil's bargain with the Ministry of Interior meant nothing. How did his death, which was one of many such deaths, spark the anger, the rage that went on to be exemplified by Wael Ghanim, who did the We Are All Khalid Saeed page on Facebook that generated a bigger outcry? Why was it Khalid Saeed's death that sparked this?
I think, as you mentioned, class had a lot to do with it. And it's something I didn't fully realize until I started doing the research and doing the interviews and really analyzing this, because it did – his wasn't the first death by police in Egypt. It wasn't the 10th. But something about this kid and his death struck such a deep and raw emotional chord in the country. And I think a lot of it had to do with class. You had the picture – that rocketed around the Egyptian internet of Khalid on the autopsy table, just looking brutalized. I mean, looking like someone who had been beaten to death. And combined that with the autopsy report, which claimed that he had – which blindly backed the police and said that he had swallowed a pack of marijuana when he saw the police coming and choked on that. It's like, okay, then why does he look like he was run over by a truck? But one of the people that I talked to for the book said that the really key picture – of Khalid Saeed that did the most damage to the regime was not the post-mortem picture, it was the before picture that went around, of just like a little passport shot of Khalid looking like everybody's Egyptian cousin, you know, kind of longish hair, a little bit of a soul patch. He was wearing a hoodie. He looked like every middle-class kid. And that was the class elements of it. He wasn't some poor farmer. He wasn't some poor taxi driver. I mean, Egypt has very complicated class dynamics. The fact that this was a middle-class kid really hit that, oh, it could happen to us.
Nobody was safe.
Right? Nobody was safe. Just walking next to the wall, to go back to that phrase, walking next to the wall will not protect me from this predatory police state. And after they come for me, there still won't be justice. There will still be a cover-up.
Right. I'm speaking with Ashraf Khalil about his book, Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation. Two issues more to discuss regarding how this whole thing was sparked on January 25th, 2011. One was Tunisia, and the other was Asma Mahfouz, the 26-year-old Egyptian woman whose message on YouTube went viral. And both of those issues seem to sort of strike at this the heart of Egyptians' sense of impotency, that if the Tunisians could throw out their dictator, what are we doing? And Asma Mahfouz, as you describe in your book, almost challenging the manhood of Egyptians to go out on January 25th and protest.
Those are two very strong elements. And I do think shame played a really strong role in this, in that the Tunisian revolution happens starting in December, culminating on January 11th. Was when Zine Abidine bin Ali fled Tunisia. And during that interim period, there really was – I mean, it was partially inspirational and partially this kind of sibling rivalry. It was like watching your little brother suddenly get his act together when you haven't. And there really was. Egyptians are very culturally arrogant. And I say this as an Egyptian citizen. You know, we tend to think that everything in the Middle East just revolves around us. And seeing the Tunisians of all people suddenly hound their dictator out, there was a kind of inspirational shame in it. The Asma Mahfouz is another very fascinating one, in that she's a longtime activist. Who, much like Khalid Saeed, looks like every middle-class Egyptian, looks like all of my cousins, basically. You know, young woman, very well-spoken, veiled, you know, wearing the Egyptian-style veil with the full face showing. And she made this iconic series of YouTube messages where, as you said, prior to the 25th, that basically she was challenging the men of Egypt to get out in the street and saying, like, you know, basically prove that you're as tough as I am. And she was angry. She was disappointed. This self-loathing that I talked about that had been building up in the country. She really gave voice to that. And she said, if you think that women should not be involved in protests, well, then get off your couch and come protect me. Prove to me that you are prove to me that you have dignity. That's the words she kept using again and again, dignity. And it was a gauntlet thrown down. It was amazing. And I talked to a lot of people. You have to put an asterisk on it because it was on YouTube. And a lot of Egyptians, you know, don't have access to the internet or don't see YouTube necessarily. But I talked to a lot of people who spoke directly of that message as a reason that drew them out of their homes on the 25th and then on the 28th. And it was amazing. I really kind of I deconstruct the Asma Mahfouz videos. I became just fascinated by this woman.
Well, let's talk about then January 25th. It happened. People showed up in huge numbers.
Yes.
But then it sustained itself. And this was what made January 25th different from previous protests. How did that decision get taken that and eventually become, you know, end up being, if we leave Tahrir Square now, we're going to get killed anyway. And that took place over the period of several weeks. But it started and then it sustained.
The 25th was amazing. The 25th was, you know, unprecedented numbers beyond anything I'd ever seen. And largely peaceful for most of the day. The crowd sort of moved all through the city. It was like there was 40 different marches happening at the same time. And it was super cool. Like for somebody like me who had watched dozens of these protests, and it's usually the same, you know, 50 usual suspects. The activists, the same activists from the last 10 protests, same journalists, same state security officers, you know, pounding on them. Everybody knows each other. And it just felt...
You call it kabuki theater and you're both at one point.
Yeah, it felt just like everybody was playing a role. And then this happened. And this was uncharted waters. And you know, you're seeing, like, you're walking with a crowd of 100 or so protesters. You turn a corner with them and there's 500 people coming your way. Protesting, and you're like watching sort of two groups of protesters hug each other and then head off in a communal direction. It was like so many things that I never thought I would see in Egypt happened on the 25th. Then you had this interim period. The protesters on the 25th did sort of take Tahrir Square, but they were run off. After midnight, there was a massive sort of tear gas and baton charge, and they scattered. Then you had like still running battles for about 2 days with everybody pointing to Friday as a big day. But the key was that interim period because the protest leaders were saying, keep taking to the streets. Don't let them rest. There was a tactical military strategy at work here, and not from any one person, from multiple places saying, don't let them rest. Keep the central security guys on their toes. Don't let them sleep. Don't let them relax.
And the protesters outnumbered the security forces for the first time.
That was the first time. I presume that on the day we were talking about in 2003 was a similar situation to that. But the 25th was the first time I'd ever seen the central security guys outnumbered because standard operating policy under Mubarak was if you get 500 protesters, we're going to surround them with 1,500 riot cops. And it was almost a comical visual because you would literally 3-1. You know, you get 1,000 protesters, we're going to bring 5,000 riot cops. And we're just going to build a wall around you. And they did this for years. So seeing the central security guys outnumbered was an amazing kind of jaw-dropping thing. 28th was the big one. That's when the protesters broke the back of the police state, broke the interior ministry.
So January 28th, 2011, 3 days after the revolution began.
Yes. And that was when they took Tahrir for good. And you ask, you know, this realization that we need to stay here. I think it was there from the very start, but by about February 2nd or 3rd, if you'll recall, on February 2nd was the day that Tahrir was besieged, the so-called Battle of the Camel, when thousands of pro-Mubarak supporters and a lot of kind of plainclothes police officers, a lot of the remnants of the police state that had been defeated the week before, laid siege to Tahrir, and it was a long and bloody, nasty battle. And I actually did not think that the protesters were going to be able to hold on. Like as of when I left to go begin filing my stories that day, I thought they were going to be overrun and slaughtered, frankly. But they held on by the skin of their teeth. they held on. And by about February 3rd or February 4th, this attitude that you were referencing had come in, saying, we cannot leave. If it, you know, even if I wanted to go home at this point, they're just going to drag me from my bed. So it's him or us.
In chapter 9 of your book entitled The Fall of the Police State, you bring up a very important point that I think was missed by progressive viewers of what was happening in Egypt. You say, let's pause to acknowledge and honor the fact that Egypt's nonviolent revolution wouldn't have happened without some people who were willing to be extremely violent at times. What do you mean by that?
I think that, yeah, it's a very nice and friendly narrative to talk about how it was peaceful all the time, but that's kind of naive. I mean, it's yes, that was very important.
And people set aside Egypt, comparing it with Syria, and Libya, saying in Syria and Libya things went south because people took up arms.
Right, right, and obviously, yeah, I think that's a naive comparison to make, in that you know the dominant ethos and chant during the protests was always Selmeyye, peaceful. Mm. And I was very impressed. I remember on the 28th being with a massive march before the clashes started, when people were still trying to start to march towards Tahrir. And I'm walking with about 5,000 strong group. And some hothead kid starts vandalizing a McDonald's advertisement in the road. And people dragged him off, chanting, yelling at him, Selmeyye, peaceful, peaceful. And I was so impressed. But we don't get there until you had to physically break the police state before all the chance of Selmeyye could really take flower. There was a military strategy. I remember seeing a PDF file that was a manual that somebody wrote up with diagrams saying how to attack the police. Here's how to attack a line of police. Here's what you should do against a paddy wagon or a troop carrier.
With what did they attack them, though?
Rocks. Rocks. Rocks and broken cement. And towards the end of the night was when the Molotovs came out. But nothing more than that. I mean, it's changed since the revolution, but Egypt is not a place where people had a lot of guns. The only people who had guns were the police.
Right.
It's almost impossible to get a license or get a gun in Egypt prior to the revolution. So, yes, there needed to be strategic violence. And the sad part of it is the people that they needed to physically defeat, it wasn't the officers. It was the ground line troops of the Central Security, who were mostly illiterate, terrified conscripts.
And what was also amazing in your book was that you point out that most of the protesters got that. And there's a great incident you describe in the beginning of your book, mm-hmm, of what happened when a group of protesters essentially accosted a bunch of these security forces that were trapped in a car. Tell us that story.
Yeah, it was. I mean, once you actually managed to defeat them, the Central Security guys immediately became pathetic. Mm. I mean, they weren't bullies. They were conscripts. They don't have a choice in the matter. They're probably the saddest people in the whole equation. You know, and there was, it wasn't 100%. There were people who just wanted to, you know, beat up and maybe kill as many of these guys as possible. But there was always calmer heads in the crowd, and I saw this in action. That you know, when you finally had situations on the 28th where the Central Security guys were at the mercy of protesters, then you know there would be this push-pull, and the hotheads would be pulled away, and others would protect these officers, or not these conscripts, from the protesters. And the scene that I opened the book with was just outside of Tahrir, just as the final police lines broke, and there was, you know, the Central Security was on the run. Their officers had disappeared, basically leaving the frontline troops to the mercy of the crowds. And a paddy wagon sort of comes barreling down the corniche just outside of Tahrir, apparently looking for escape. But it didn't stand a chance. It was immediately surrounded by protesters, pounded with rocks. It sort of crashes into a highway median. The driver is injured and sort of semi-coherent. And the way that this was told to me was someone who was on the scene said that the driver is just going – is just barely making sense. He's saying, just kill me. Just kill me. I don't want to live anymore. Mm-hmm. And there were people in the crowd that wanted to tear this guy apart. But other people took him, saved him, pulled him out of the truck, took him to a bench by the Nile, and were like hugging this guy, partially to protect him – and partially to console this man. The other soldiers were trapped inside the truck, like the door to the back of the truck became jammed in the crash. So there's this there's a hatch at the top of the truck, and people are sort of negotiating with these completely terrified. You know, these are farm kids, half of them. If you meet these central security guys, it's really hard to hate them. And there's this negotiation, and finally sort of a slightly unfair, I suppose, deal was struck saying, okay, we're going to let you go home. You're going to go home safely, but you're going to leave those uniforms behind. You're walking home in your underwear. And they did. And I think the uniforms and the riot clubs and the shields, you know, probably became souvenirs for a few dozen protesters. But I think one of the key things was that there was an acknowledgement, not among everybody, but among enough of the protesters, that we are not attacking central security because central security is the problem. We are attacking central security because this is the only way to force Mubarak to deal with us honestly. It's necessary to defeat you. We don't hate you, but we have to physically vanquish you.
I'm speaking with Ashraf Khalil, independent correspondent based in Cairo, Egypt, and we're discussing his new book, Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation. Part of Mubarak's strategy during this time was to shut down the internet and cell phone service. What role did that play in a movement that had relied significantly on the internet? And how did you as a journalist deal with not having internet access?
It was interesting because, you know, the internet was shut down on the night of the 27th, which was an amazing move. Like, that was unprecedented. The morning of the 28th, the cell phones go down. And it turned out to not mean anything strategically, because at that point it was too far gone. It was much too little too late. And the protesters on the 28th had very cleverly, they probably saw this coming, and I'm sure it was on the list of possibilities, but a total cell phone shutdown around the country was, wow. I mean, I don't even know the technical details of that. But the protesters on the 28th, basically, there wasn't any need for coordination at that point because they just said, you know what, after Friday prayers, just protest everywhere, wherever you are, protest and keep going. And, you know, how do you don't need communication at that point. The effect it had on the ground was amazing. It didn't stop the protesters, and it ultimately didn't stop the journalists from getting their story out. What it did was create this amazing kind of – it's like Cairo became this almost like storyteller, verbal storyteller, oral tradition society for a day or two. You had no idea what was happening anywhere else in the country. You had no idea what was happening three blocks away. On the 25th, everybody seemed to be on their smartphone, you know, either tweeting or checking what was happening. When there were deaths in Suez on the 28th in protest, everybody in Tahrir knew it immediately. On the 28th, you had no idea what was happening even across the river. So you had no choice but to fight like hell for whatever patch of ground you were on and then fight through to the next patch. And I think there was a lot of people that I talked to that theorized that the communications shutdown actually drew more people out into the streets just out of curiosity. And then when they saw what was happening, they joined the protests. As a journalist, it was very interesting because, I mean, basically what I ended up doing was on the 28th that morning, I was interviewed by the BBC. They had sort of a rooftop studio across the Nile from Tahrir. And it was while we were about to go live that everybody's cell phone died. So I was like, by the time I was kind of scared when we went on the air because that was new. By the end of the day, I cover the protests. By about 6 o'clock, I need to go start filing. You know, one of my clients at the time was the Times of London, so they had very early deadlines. And I basically walked straight back to the BBC and cut them a spontaneous deal and said, I will be your on-air pundit every hour on the hour. I'll tell you everything I've seen. I'll do television. I'll do radio. But I need a desk. I need an internet connection because they had satellite internet. They had their own dedicated satellite internet connection.
So you had to improvise.
So I bartered, basically. I was like, I'll be your pundit. Don't pay me. Just give me a computer.
The journalists were targeted pretty severely. And you recount in the book your own sort of moment of terror where – you say that your own Egyptian passport became a bit of a liability. Anderson Cooper, of course, was attacked and went on to become one of the staunchest defenders of the revolution on American television. So in a way, these attacks on journalists backfired. Share with us briefly what happened to you as well.
Okay, what happened to me was basically. On February 2nd, as I said, was the day that Tahrir was besieged by pro-Mubarak supporters. February 3rd, there weren't as many attacks on Tahrir, but that was the day that dozens of journalists were attacked. And it happened so suddenly that it couldn't have been an accident. And what happened with me was I was with a group of other journalists. We weren't anywhere near Tahrir, actually. We were across the river. It's morning. We're driving around. We see some people at a cart eating cooked fava beans, which is sort of the national dish of Egypt. And they were just guys having their breakfast in a middle-class neighborhood. So we're like, great, let's do some vox pop, some man-on-the-street interviews. We get out, and I'm with foreigners, one of whom is a radio reporter. So as you know, she's walking around with a big microphone that draws attention. And we're not even asking about politics. We're asking, hey, have people started to return to work yet? Are there supplies in the stores? You know, how are you feeling in general? And it kind of turned south very quickly. People were suspicious of us. They wanted to see our ID cards. So people were asking if we were from Jazeera.
And Al Jazeera was severely targeted throughout the revolution.
Yes. Yeah. And it's actually – and so I ended up getting sort of punched in the face about four times. And it wasn't too bad. A lot of people got it worse. And we were actually saved by the army. Mm. An army officer did it. And the thing that happened – I'm actually – of the opinion, I don't think it was some mob of pro-Mubarak provocateurs or anything that targeted us. I think it was just regular citizens who had been driven half crazy by this steady stream of state media telling them that foreign agents, that it was this toxic combination of sort of Mossad agents and CIA and Jazeera. Apparently, they're all getting together and they're in a room with the Muslim Brotherhood and they're all planning. It was this amazing cabal of plotters against Egypt.
So let's skip to February 10th, the day that everybody expected Hosni Mubarak to step down.
Yes.
Where, you know, they're in Tahrir Square. And I remember that time here covering this from the other part of the world, planning a show around expecting Hosni Mubarak to step down, listening to his speech live on CNN at the radio station. Everybody's in Tahrir Square. And then he didn't step down.
That was amazing. And it really wasn't until halfway through the speech that it was this sort of growing realization, because everybody thought he was going to step down. And I'm convinced – I think one of the final mysteries of the revolution that I was unable to unravel – it's going to have to wait for someone to write their memoir in 10 years who was involved in this – is what messages went from Cairo to Washington,
right,
especially because the Obama administration, I think, was flat out off the record telling journalists that Mubarak is stepping down tonight. So they either badly misread the signals, or they were lied to, or the plan changed at the last minute on the Mubarak end. And so everybody thought he was going to step down. It was, you know, Tahrir was euphoric. And I watched the speech from Tahrir. They had video screens set up, you know, like bedsheet projectors set up. And by about 5 minutes in, you're starting to get this feeling just based on the tone. He's kind of launching this very long and whiny recap of his glorious service to the nation. And I remember a guy just over my shoulder, about 5 minutes in, we're all starting to get this like, wait a minute. And this guy right behind my shoulder just goes, does that look like someone who's leaving? He won't be, so we'll just have to remove him. And the sheer rage as people kind of realized that they weren't going to hear that magic sentence that everyone had gathered for. And by the end of it, the feeling in Tahrir was kind of equal parts deflated, but rage. I spoke with a school teacher, a young school teacher in her 30s, right after the speech. And I just found the first person I could and say, how do you feel right now? And she said, I feel hatred. I feel like we need to drag him from his palace. And it was such a shocking statement. Even at these late stages, I was like, do you want me to write your name? I can do this anonymously. I just say, 30-year-old school teacher. She's like, no, my name is Mayada Morsi. Write it down. And that's – I mean, she had passed her own point
of no return.
Yeah.
So then a day later, it was over. But wasn't Mubarak announcing it? It was the beginning of the formation of the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces. And you say what started as a popular mass uprising had ended with a palace coup. And what happened in the aftermath of the Egyptian Revolution is something we've covered on our show a lot. And a lot of listeners here in the U.S. of KPFK know that the aftermath of the revolution has been almost a sort of part two with massive targeting of the civilian population by this army that was supposed to be looking out for the people's interests. You say 12,000 civilians were tried in military tribunals.
At least.
So it's almost as though the Mubarak's fate is kind of moved to the background now. And the new focus of protests is the army. So let's talk about what's happening. What happened? You talk about last summer as being very, very momentous. This was a very difficult time for Egyptians.
Well, I mean, even on February 11th, there was some – on the day Mubarak stepped down and ceded power to the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which was this very little-known collection of generals. They were around before, but I don't think most Egyptians could name more than three of them before. And suddenly they're holding – power in the country.
So the council actually existed before.
It wasn't formed. Yes, it existed. It existed as a military advisory council. It was there before. Mm. But like I said, I doubt most Egyptians could name more than three of them. Suddenly they're running the country. And there was a lot of faith in them at the beginning. It wasn't universal. There were some activists who, even on February 11th, were saying, why is everyone so happy about this? Why would we trust the generals? They've been getting fat off this regime as much as anybody. Why would they have our best interests at heart? But these people were in the minority. Over the months, they really have eroded whatever good faith they have. And as you said, there was this strange dedication to putting civilians on military trials, which I could never understand. Because we still have a functioning judiciary. The Egyptian judiciary is actually pretty good. They were weirdly uncorrupted during the Mubarak era. There was a number of missteps. There was this either a refusal or an inability to really take on the interior ministry. And that, I think, is one of the larger crimes that I lay at the feet of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, of the SCAF, in that the changes in the interior ministry were cosmetic at best. They renamed this notorious Emn al-Dawla, state security. They renamed it national security. So what? And they shuffled some generals around. They really didn't do anything to change this borderline criminal organization that was at the heart of the regime. There have been so many other elements, and now things have gotten so bad that between the activists and the military, there's just borderline hatred. Mm. And we saw some of that in November and December when there were fresh clashes, and the way that the soldiers were dealing with the protesters. This was not some sort of professional, military operation. There was hatred in their actions.
Finally, Ashraf Khalil, your book is called Liberation Square, Inside the Egyptian Revolution and the Rebirth of a Nation. Would you say that the revolution is not over?
Yes. I think we're still trying to complete it. It's, there's almost a fun semantic game in Egypt as to whether or not people are calling for a second revolution or just going, no, why don't we just finish the first one? Mm. The revolution was not completed. And I do lay that at the feet of the military and maybe at the feet of the people who were willing to sort of give the military a chance. But I don't blame them for that even. It's not done yet. It needs to be completed. And I think it starts with getting the generals out of power. And it starts with massive, radical overt restructuring of the interior ministry. And then we'll go from there. But whatever's happening in Egypt is going to take – it's on a 10-year timeline. And it can only be a good thing that they just had a reasonably successful election. I mean, I know the results may freak some people out. You do have an Islamist majority in parliament. But nobody's questioning the validity or the sincerity of the elections. And that by itself is a massive thing.
Well, Ashraf Khalil, there seems like there'll be plenty of material for you in 5 years to write another book about,
yep.
or maybe in less than that.
Just maybe.
I want to thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank
you. This was fun.